This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Liz Pelka. Security forces in Myanmar have responded to protesters by opening fire at a power plant Sunday. Meanwhile, the U.S. Embassy in Myanmar urged American citizens to shelter in place, citing reports of the military movements in Yangon. It also warned there was a possibility of a telecoms interruption overnight between 1 a.m. and 9 a.m. Armored vehicles rolled into major cities as the new army rulers faced a ninth day of anti-coup demonstrations that saw hundreds of thousands participating. Soldiers were deployed to power plants in the northern region, leading to a confrontation with demonstrators, some of whom said they believed the army intended to cut off electricity. The government and army could not be reached for comment. Monday holds the prospect of two flashpoints for the political standoff, a court appearance by ousted national leader Aung San Suu Kyi, and a possible announcement of a death of a young protester shot last week. The UK government says it has reached its goal of giving at least one COVID-19 vaccine shot to the most vulnerable people in the country. The development increases pressure on ministers to clarify when they will ease a lockdown imposed in early January. Some 15 million people, or 22% of the UK population, have received their first shot or were offered one. The figure includes most people in the government's top four priority groups, including everyone over 75, frontline healthcare workers and nursing home staff. Former U.S. President Donald Trump's acquittal on charges of inciting a deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol left Democrats and Republicans deeply divided on Sunday. More on VOAnews.com. This is VOA News. Kosovars began voting on Sunday in a parliamentary election that an anti-establishment party is expected to win, further complicating Western efforts to resolve the country's decades-long territorial dispute with Serbia. The State Election Commission said turnout by 11 a.m. local time was 8.3%. That's one percentage point lower than in the last election in 2019, mainly due to freezing temperatures. Rescuers pulled out nine more bodies from the site of a flash flood in a Himalayan region of northern India on Sunday, a week after the disaster struck. The death toll is now 50, with more than 150 people still missing, according to officials. The flash flood in Uttarakhand state, triggered by what scientists said could have been a large avalanche of glacier ice, sent water, rocks, and debris surging down the Dauli Ganga River Valley. Dams and bridges were destroyed. Rescuers are using heavy digging machinery in a race to free dozens of dam construction workers trapped in an underground tunnel connected to a hydroelectric project. Rwanda said on Sunday it has commenced COVID-19 vaccinations with limited supplies of vaccines. The inoculations were acquired through unnamed international partners, and officials said the program had started with frontline healthcare workers. The Central African nation has been battling a surge in infections of COVID-19, which forced the government to reimpose a lockdown last month in the capital, Kigali. Authorities banned movement in and out of the city, except for essential services and for tourists. In a tweet, Rwanda's Ministry of Health said the country's national vaccination program had begun vaccinating high-risk groups, notably frontline healthcare staff, with WHO-approved COVID-19 vaccines acquired through international partnerships in limited quantities. Sunday, Britain downplayed the risk of the European Union taking business away from the City of London after Brexit. According to Foreign Minister Dominic Raab, the real challenges come from New York, Tokyo, and other areas. Britain completed its exit from the EU at the end of 2020, but the last-minute free trade deal that replaced membership of the bloc did not include arrangements for free trade and financial services, the engine of Britain's economy. Via remote, I'm Liz Pelka, VOA News.
This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, East Africa's continued turmoil and how best the U.S. Africa Command can both assist government forces in that region as well as respond directly to armed threats, and how a drawdown in U.S. forces in parts of East Africa will affect stability operations. Hello, I'm Jeffrey Young, sitting in for Carol Castiel. With us to discuss East Africa's insurgencies, their ideologies, and the forces behind them are, joining Encounter remotely, Colin Clark in Pittsburgh and Xavier Ichani in Nairobi, Kenya, as we continue to practice social distancing in Washington. Mr. Clark is with the Soufan Center in New York City, and Dr. Ichani is with Kenyatta University in Nairobi. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
East Africa for years has had Muslim extremism, Al-Shabaab primarily in Somalia and various other elements of Al-Qaeda, along with recent attacks, including one at the Africa Hotel in Mogadishu and the unsuccessful targeting of Somali's president and prime minister in another city. Fighting in the town of Bulawahara has sent people fleeing from there and also from the nearby Kenyan border town of Mandera. Meanwhile, the previous U.S. presidential administration began a drawdown of the 700 U.S. troops stationed in Somalia. In light of the ongoing situation in Somalia, what is the best way forward both for Somali forces and for U.S. Africa Command, which was there to train elite Somali counterterrorism units? What's your perspective, Dr. Ichani?
Before I really answer that question, I want us a little bit to go back and see the mandate and perhaps the issues revolving about the American intervention in the East Africa. You'll note that the U.S. AFRICOM has the mandate that runs through intelligence gathering, also recognizes issues, as well occasionally falling into kinetic action, where it's involved in direct hostilities with this. Although the mandate is very clear, that is basically about training and professionalizing the security organs in Eastern Africa and the rest of Africa, you need to note that Africa is a continent of both hope and despair. In that hope, it is building and it has enormous economic resources, but as well as its despair because it is home to insurgency and rise of terrorism in the recent past. And most of the armies within or the security organs within East Africa have evolved from what sometimes I call rudimentary forces. Some of these have been in a war-torn country. When you're speaking about Somalia, it has been having no government, total failure or a failed state for over 25 years. And therefore, if the United States, for instance, the AFRICOM, will not obviously be engaged in kinetic action against the possibility or the capability of the Somali forces to contain, the issues of terrorism will not be achieved in reality. So basically, there are two ways in which the United States Africa Command can act on this. The first one is to provide intelligence as is intended in the mandate, but occasionally it has to intervene directly so as to control the spread of this. We're also aware that insurgencies can only not be fought through the military action. It's beyond that. The military is maybe sufficient, but not maybe necessary, yes, but not sufficient enough to address the issues of insurgencies and terrorism. And therefore, there is need to explore both the carrot and stick measures when we come to dealing with issues of insurgencies.
Dr. Clark, what do you think of what Dr. Ichani has just said? What about his positions?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's right on a number of points. First, that any kind of U.S. assistance needs to be intelligence driven, which is going to be more difficult with forces not actually on the ground in Somalia. But that one of the truisms of counterinsurgency, and we've known this for a long time, is that it can't be a purely kinetic campaign. There's got to be a more comprehensive approach looking at what some of the major issues are plaguing Somalia, including governance, including the strength of the judiciary and institutions, And so there's a number of issues to look at. And this isn't something new. We've been analyzing these kind of same collection of factors and variables for several decades now, looking at the ongoing instability and overlapping conflicts in the Horn of Africa.
While I have your attention right now, you are one of the experts in terrorist financing and revenue streams. Al-Shabaab has been going on and on and on for years in the Horn of Africa. How are they supporting themselves? What is the revenue stream? Are they doing taxation like the Islamic State was doing in the areas in Syria that it conquered, et cetera? Give us an idea as to the revenue flows that support Al-Shabaab and other insurgents in East Africa. Where are they getting their money?
Well, it's ebbed and flowed over time. There's been various points when they've focused on the sugar trade. There's been connections to charcoal. We do know that extortion and taxation are a major funding stream as well. And while it's important to focus on the credits, all the money that the groups bring in, it's also important to focus on debits. This is a group that doesn't necessarily have high debits. They're not paying for a whole lot. And so the money that they bring in lasts for a long time and is able to facilitate, you know, some of the operations we've seen that this group is capable of conducting. And still, it remains capable of conducting what we call spectacular attacks, not only in Mogadishu, but in the surrounding areas, and as well outside of Somalia, as it's proven in the past.
Dr. Ajani, I want to bring this back to you now. Again, Al-Shabaab and other bad actors have been in the region now for years. What is their base of support? Do people really want an Islamic caliphate in the Horn of Africa? Is this just a goal of groups like Al-Shabaab to impose their power and their governance on other people? Where's the support base for this? How do these insurgents keep going?
To respond to your question, we need to note that groups that use force, or rather terrorists as discussed here, do not operate in a vacuum. Some of these groups have a wider following, a constituency of its own. They have sympathizers across the countries. And in the case of Somalia, we have factions in terms of clans that have supported the idea of Sharia law. And therefore, Al-Shabaab is appealing to them. Note that they interpret any intervention as external, as occupation in their land. And therefore, when they do this, they are able to elicit the support of their constituents. And they join hands, they contribute funds, as Dr. Clark has said, to support the organizations. And one very critical issue we're about to note about this Al-Shabaab, right from the beginning of when the government of Siad Barre was overthrown, we had it come as what we talked of as Islamic Union. And this later on transformed to what we call Islamic Court Union. Upon the Ethiopian intervention in 2006, it transformed into Al-Shabaab. And as the much talked Greek myth of the Hydra, that a reptile with two heads, where when you chop two germinate. These insurgents or terrorists in Somalia have been transforming or metamorphosing every now and then. And the second one becomes more militant adept and is capable of using any kind of action against the perceived interveners or those who are opposing it. Sometimes the issue is perceived as if it is the struggle against two civilizations. We talk of the Western civilization dominated by the Christians, and that's perhaps where the US and the African command comes from, in support with the partners like Kenya, which is also perceived to be primarily Christian. And therefore, it is a clash of two civilizations, in the words of Samuel Huntington, where now Christianity is pitched against Islam. And therefore, this brings an appeal to what we even talk of anti-racist sentiments among these particular groups that fighting within Somalia and jeopardizing security within the East African region as that.
What do you think, Dr. Clark? What's your reaction to what Dr. Ajani just said?
No, I mean, I think Dr. Ajani clearly knows the history of Somalia and many of the problems plaguing the country. And I largely agree. I think analyzing this from the not looking as much as the at the insurgents, but the counterinsurgents, what does the United States need to do to be able to assist? Look, this is all part of the larger conversation that's going on in the U.S. national security establishment about does the United States continue the global war on terror, the poorly named global war on terror, or is there a more fundamental shift toward what we call great power competition, toward conflict with China, Russia, Iran, other nation states? And I argue that the United States can and should do both. This isn't, you know, an either or matter. I think the United States needs to continue countering the influence of those aforementioned countries. But still, we can't just walk away from a counterterrorism fight and allow groups like Al-Shabaab and other groups operating throughout Africa in the Sahel and other parts of sub-Saharan Africa to grow, to flourish, to network, and to potentially turn their sights on Western targets. So I think we need to keep applying pressure. We need to keep working closely with the Somalis. And unfortunately, there's a bit of a stalemate, and it requires strategic patience, but also giving AFRICOM the resources needed to continue this fight.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. Joining me remotely are Dr. Colin Clark, a terrorism expert with the Soufan Center in New York, and Professor Xavier Francis Ichani at the School of Security, Diplomacy, and Peace Studies at Kenyatta University in Nairobi. We're discussing the continued turmoil in parts of East Africa and what the U.S. Africa Command can do to support government forces and help ensure stability. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a big shout out to a loyal listener from Gombe, Nigeria, Bar Inusa Mohammed. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Now back to our program on the security situation in East Africa. Another aspect of this discussion worth bringing up is the role of transnational bodies, such as the Sahel 5 in West Africa, which is five regional nations joined together to fight Al-Qaeda and other bad actors in that area. What multilateral security arrangements exist in East Africa, and how can they be best used to suppress insurgent activity? Mr. Ichani, I'll let you go first.
There are possibly one or two ways to go about this. One, we need to note that the military performs a key issues when it comes to enhancing the U.S. foreign policy on other states. And basically, that is the foundation of AFRICOM. One, the military has to work to defeat the enemy. The military has to coerce. It has also to defeat and deter, sometimes to compel the groups. But also, the use of kinetic force is very significant in reassuring the people that the military wants to protect. So what we can borrow is that there is need of good cooperation between the partners and the U.S. AFRICOM. But whereas in East Africa, we have partners like Kenya that are able to join hands with the United States in the war against terror. In the Sahel region, it's a bit different. Note that the group or the we have sub-Saharan population here that shares between two different, so to speak, races are that. We have a Muslim segment of population as well as the Christian segment of population. And therefore, when it goes to where people ascribe to Islam, you'll find much resistance towards the AFRICOM operations. And therefore, as I said earlier, that there is need to marry two, the use of military force as well as diplomatic measures so that we can share with the terrorists, not engaging really in a discussion or dialogue, but need to understand what are these matters that motivate groups and youths to ascribe to using force. And once we get note of this, there is need to build the capacities of these partners or the countries where insurgencies are running. And after building the capacity, then we shall be able to have a sustainable appeal. Just as Dr. Clark said, that the war against terrorism will not take a day or two. It is going to last for some ages. It's bound to be a protracted conflict. And we should be aware of that and proceed using this two-pronged approach, the military action as well as diplomatic measures that are able to bring these groups into perhaps a negotiation, such as also to scale down their activities. There are quite a number of range of actions that can be undertaken under the engagement forum, the engagement approach with groups that use force. Occasionally, they will not wish to be called terrorists. That's why I'm shifting from groups that use force and occasionally use terrorists at that kind of discussion.
I want to bring something up here. The African Union, which of course is headquartered in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, has among its stated goals to promote, quote, peace, security, and stability on the continent, unquote. Several times, the AU has deployed multinational forces to Burundi, to Sudan, to Somalia. Should the African Union ramp up its security efforts so that there is an AU military presence on board when these regional conflicts erupt? Dr. Clark, what do you think about that?
Look, I think it's an all-hands-on-deck approach. It depends on what we're looking at in the region. There's just so many different hotspots at the moment. If you look at the proliferation of groups, if you look at Al-Qaeda and ISIS competing to recruit new members, to finance their organizations, to conduct attacks, what's happening in the Sahel looks different than what's happening in the Horn, which is different than what's happening down in Mozambique. So I think there's a question of priorities, there's a question of resources, and there's a question of having countries like the United States or France, in the case of the Sahel, act as force multipliers, perhaps, for these regional organizations like the AU, like AMISOM, like others, to see what the United States or France can bring to the table that's a complement and not redundant to what these local forces are already doing on the ground.
Now let's bring up another part of the turmoil in East Africa, and that's political instability. It's not just terrorism. Sudan and South Sudan are excellent examples of this. I mean, in South Sudan, we have the endless fight between Salva Kiir and Riek Machar, and there seems to be little or no resolution. It's one guy or the other guy, and regardless of who steps out and who steps into the fight, the other one still wants to be in the conflict. Then we had the whole situation in Sudan. Bashir is gone. They're now reestablishing themselves. Speak to the political side of the instabilities in East Africa, Dr. Nshani.
What I would say perhaps is that the African Union has a well-crafted framework to deal with issues of insecurity and political upheavals. But this is more, I can say perhaps, very novel way. They are talking of the issue of silencing the guns by 2020, which was last year. They have their Africa peace and security architecture, which well works on this. But there is also lack of that political will among to support some of these issues. And we realize that everything about politics, everything about security revolves about the politics of the state and that. And therefore, there is sometimes what we can term as not very keen to restore peace. This is a place where heads of states are talking about no term limits. They're also talking about not having kinetic action against insurgency group in some places, that this is about American neocolonialism. This is about having America secure her interest in these countries. But what we need is a balance between the two. And I believe that once we have good governance running on, then things are able to go in the correct order.
Dr. Clark, and your reaction?
I think, again, at this point, it's a wholesale reassessment. We're also in the United States transitioning from one administration to another. The Trump administration and the way that it viewed security was very much through a zero-sum lens in some parts of the world. And even against advice from top policymakers, military leaders, there was this tendency to want to withdraw and to pull back from certain parts of the world. I don't think the United States should get involved in providing kind of nation building type support. Clearly, that's not something the U.S. has done a good job at. If you look at the track record of the last 20 years in places like Afghanistan and Iraq, but there are clear aspects of security cooperation and building partner capacity that the U.S. is quite good at, including logistics. There's just certain things that the U.S. military can do that, with all due respect, no other country can do. And that extends to ISR, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. So I think there are real tangible objectives that the U.S. can pursue from a regional security standpoint throughout different parts of Africa. And now with the Biden administration, there's going to be a fair chance for that to happen. There's the political will for that. And I think there's going to be more of a coherent strategy with the U.S. operating in Africa and the Middle East and other kind of global hotspots that we could expect to see more than just rhetoric.
There's the endless balancing back and forth between security and development. AFRICOM, USAID, in a lot of situations, development helps negate the insurgency and makes it possible once there's inclusion. And that's the point that I wanted to finish up on. If there's political and economic inclusion, there is less of a chance of insurgency. This is what I have learned directly from being in the Middle East, from being in Iraq, and being in other places like that. Let's reflect on East Africa, on the idea of political and economic inclusion. Dr. Achani, what do you think?
Absolutely right, Mr. Yang, that political inclusion, or rather addressing the grievances of these communities and groups that use force, will play a key role in terms of ending some of this violence. Remember that some groups are because of grievances that are unresolved. And in the African context, we talk of historical injustice among several states, which have not been addressed. And some of these groups are maybe motivated to undertake violence because they have been excluded politically. And there is evidence among even militia groups in the context of Kenya, where these groups have been, for us, been governed in some extent or included, but provided with their grievances solved. And they turn their operations. So it's very important that that is understood in the context of wider application to use counterterrorism attacks. Some of these groups have legitimate issues that need to be discussed within the societies. And I think I concur with you that there is need to interlace the issues of defense with the issues of development, which are very key in making even these issues of security sustainable.
Dr. Clark, and what's your finishing thought on that?
I mean, I think we all recognize that an all-inclusive kind of whole-of-government style approach, political, economic, security, is what is in order. But I just caution that that's a long-term approach. That's something that needs to be sustained over time. And again, many times in the West, in the United States, and some European partners, there's a desire for a quick fix. I mean, you have politicians running on short election cycles, and they want to be able to show tangible results. So I think we need to look at this in longer timeframes if the desire is to be more inclusive economically, which I think it should be. But we also have to be cognizant that oftentimes those providing assistance are seeking kind of the silver bullet. And that's just not something that is likely attainable in certain parts of the world, including, I think, in East Africa.
Good point. And on that note, I'm afraid that's all the time that we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Colin P. Clark, with the Soufan Center in New York, and
Dr. Xavier Francis Ichani from Kenyatta University School of Security, Diplomacy, and Peace Studies in Nairobi. He currently has been joining us from Juba. VOA thanks you both for your time and valuable insights into this very intractable and difficult and seemingly endless situation in East Africa. VOA Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm VOA's Jeffrey Young, sitting in for Carol Castillo. Join us again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners, so we speak a bit slower, and we use words and sentences especially written for people learning English. Here are the stories we have for you on today's program. First, the education report. Dan Friedel and Katie Weaver talk about the issue of teaching race and slavery in American schools. I will return with this week's words and their stories. Today we talk about Valentine's Day. February 14th is Valentine's Day in the United States. So I will talk about a love-related idiom. We will finish our 30 minutes together with The Making of a Nation, our ongoing U.S. history program. But first, here is the education report.
How history should be taught in American schools is a subject forcefully argued by many different American groups. One example of the ongoing dispute was an effort by the administration of former President Donald Trump. It sought to influence the way American history, including slavery and race, are discussed in public schools and universities. In November of 2020, Trump ordered the Department of Education to establish a group called the 1776 Commission. Its stated job was to better enable rising generations to understand the history and principles of the founding of the United States in 1776. However, critics said the group told a one-sided story about the men who helped establish the United States, known as the Founding Fathers. They argued the commission told schools to reduce the importance of slavery when telling the story of the early days of the country. The commission released its report on January 18th. The Trump administration hoped it would provide guidance about history teaching in the country. But critics said it insulted many ideas of education. David Blight is a Civil War historian at Yale University. He called the document produced by Trump's commission a piece of right-wing propaganda.
Observers noted that the report seemed to be an answer to the 1619 Project. It is a series of stories published in 2019 in the New York Times newspaper. The stories are about the influence of slavery on the British colonies that would become the United States. The New York Times collection was released during the 400th anniversary of the year historians believe slaves were first brought to the area that would become the United States. The stories talked about how African slaves provided free labor in some colonies. The writers argued that slaves made the agricultural economy one of the most productive in the world. They said that slavery began hundreds of years of racism and poor conditions from which Black people have yet to fully recover. The 1619 Project won the Pulitzer Prize and resulted in a podcast. The New York Times said it looks at how slavery started nearly everything that has truly made America exceptional. President Joe Biden canceled the 1776 Commission with an executive order on the first day of his presidency, January 20th. However, state leaders who supported the commission still want to influence how public school teachers and public universities discuss the effects of slavery and racism.
In the state of Georgia, a lawmaker asked the leader of the state's university system to investigate how teachers talk about white privilege. White privilege is a term used to describe the advantages that come just from being white in American society. The term appeared a lot in the summer of 2020 after protests over racial equity took place following the death of George Floyd. He was a Black man who died while being restrained by police in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Lawmakers in Georgia asked the state university system to survey its professors on the issue of white privilege. English professor Matthew Bodie teaches at the University of North Georgia. He saw the survey. He said it is designed to intimidate professors and called it an attack on higher education. The debate is not only in Georgia. States including Arkansas and Iowa are dealing with the same issues. Representative from Arkansas Mark Lowry called slavery a dark stain on U.S. history, but said the New York Times series reduced the importance of founding fathers like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, who were slave owners.
Nicole Hannah-Jones is a reporter for the New York Times and creator of the project. She said the New York Times series is not supposed to replace what schools traditionally teach. It is supposed to ask people to think about what came from slavery. Some high school teachers are using the educational plans that go with the New York Times project to provide their students with a new understanding of slavery. Jonathan Rogers is an English teacher in Iowa. He said the 1619 Project is valuable. It helped his students think about different sources or alternative storytelling, he said. One proposal in Oklahoma calls for teachers to lose their jobs if they teach divisive issues. In South Dakota, the governor proposed adding almost $1 million to the state's budget to make sure schools teach that the U.S. is the most unique nation in the history of the world. Tate Reeves is governor of Mississippi. He proposed $3 million to fight against what he called revisionist history, or the changing of traditional historic accounts. He said teachers around the U.S. have placed attention on what he called America's shortcomings over the exceptional achievements of this country. Arkansas's Governor Asa Hutchinson said what is taught in schools is something that should be dealt with by parents, not by the state. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Dan Friedel.
To help protect yourself against the new coronavirus, wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, and after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. If you cannot wash your hands with soap and water, use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Taking these steps can help prevent not only the new coronavirus disease, but also colds, flu, and other viruses. For more information, visit the following websites: the World Health Organization at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. February 14th is Valentine's Day in the United States. For many people, it is a romantic day. It's the day to show your love for that special someone in your life. Usually a boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, or wife. Of course, you should do that every day. But on Valentine's Day, there is a special pressure to do so with a gift. Popular gifts for this holiday include flowers, candy, and a card. Or maybe a nice dinner out in a restaurant. Some people use Valentine's Day to declare their love for someone. Just be careful. A declaration of love is a serious move. And if the person you love is also a friend, you may put your friendship at risk. There is no turning back. Once you say the words, "I love you." In other words, there is no putting that genie back in the bottle. Or maybe it happens the other way around for you. Maybe Valentine's Day is the day you find out that you have a secret admirer. That happened to me once, and it was very awkward. One Valentine's Day many years ago, an old flame of mine showed up at my door unexpectedly, out of the blue. In one hand, he had chocolates. In the other, some beautiful flowers. He told me that he never stopped thinking of me, and that he still loved me. I was shocked. I had not seen him in over a year. Then my shock turned to pity, because I did not feel the same way. While he had carried a torch for me all those months, I had gotten over him a long time ago. Still, I invited him in for a cup of tea. After all, he had just flown into town. When I told him that I did not feel the same way, he did not waste a minute. He turned to my roommate, handed her the flowers, and asked, "What about you?" Both of us shouted the same thing, "Get out!" So I guess he wasn't carrying a torch for me after all. In British English, a torch is a simple flashlight. But in the U.S., a torch is fire or a flame on a stick. If you say you carry a torch for someone, you mean you are carrying a flaming love for them in your heart. But usually, you secretly love them from a distance. And often, those strong feelings are not returned. We have a special way to describe this type of heartbreak. Unrequited love. That is an advanced way of saying unreturned love, which we don't really say. I like to describe unrequited love as love traveling in one direction, down a dark, lonely, dead-end street, going nowhere. People started using the idiom to carry a torch for someone in the early 1900s. Around the same time, torch song and torch singer also became common terms. Many of us have carried a torch for someone. That is why torch songs became common. Singers sound as if they are filled with pain as the unrequited flame of love burns deeply inside them. Torch songs are filled with yearning, wishing, and hoping with all your heart that the person you love will love you back. And that is all the time we have for this Words in Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation. American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Bob Doty and I discuss American arts and popular culture during the 1930s. Hard economic times and social conflict have always offered a rich source of material for artists and writers. A painter's colors can show the drying of dreams or the flight of the human spirit. A musician can express the tensions and uncertainty of a people in struggle. The pressures of hard times can be the force to lift a writer's imagination to new heights. So it was during the 1930s in the United States. The severe economic crisis, the Great Depression, created an atmosphere for artistic imagination and creative expression. The common feeling of struggle also led millions of Americans to look to films, radio, and other new art forms for relief from their day-to-day cares.
The most popular sound of the 1930s was a new kind of music, swing music. And the king of swing was a clarinet player named Benny Goodman. Benny
Benny Goodman and other musicians made swing music extremely popular during the 1930s. Swing music was a new form of jazz. Many of its first players were black musicians in small, unknown groups. It was only when more well-known white musicians started playing swing music in the middle 1930s that the new music became wildly popular.
One reason for the popularity of swing music was the growing power of radio during the 1930s. Radio had already proven in earlier years that it could be an important force in both politics and popular culture. Millions of Americans bought radios during the 1920s. But radio grew up in the 1930s. Producers became more skillful in creating programs. And actors and actresses began to understand the special needs and power of this new electronic art form. Swing music was not the only kind of music that radio helped make popular. The 1930s also saw increasing popularity for traditional classical music by Beethoven, Bach, and other great musicians. In 1930, the Columbia Broadcasting System began a series of concerts by the New York Philharmonic Orchestra on Sunday afternoons. The next year, the National Broadcasting Company, NBC, began weekly opera concerts.
In 1937, NBC asked Arturo Toscanini of Italy to lead an orchestra on American radio. Toscanini was the greatest orchestra leader of his day. Millions of Americans listened at Christmas time as Toscanini and the NBC orchestra began playing the first of 10 special radio concerts. It was a great moment for both music and radio. For the first time, millions of average Americans were able to hear classical music by great musicians as it was being played.
Music was an important reason why millions of Americans gathered to listen to the radio during the 1930s. But even more popular were a series of weekly programs with exciting or funny new actors. Families would come home from school or work and laugh at the foolish experiences of such actors as Jack Benny, Fred Allen, George Burns, Edgar Bergen, and W.C. Fields. Radio helped people forget the hard conditions of the Great Depression. And it helped to bring Americans together and share experiences.
Swing music, classical music, great comedy programs. The 1930s truly were a golden period for radio and mass communications. But it was also during this period that Hollywood and the American film industry became much more skilled and influential. In previous years, films were silent, but the talkies arrived in the 1930s.
Directors could produce films in which actors could talk. Americans reacted by attending film theaters by the millions. It was a great time for Hollywood. The films had exciting new actors. Spencer Tracy, Betty Davis, Katharine Hepburn, the young Shirley Temple. The most famous film of the period was Gone with the Wind, with Clark Gable and Vivian Leigh in the starring roles of Rhett Butler and Scarlett O'Hara.
No, I don't think I will kiss you. Although you need kissing badly. That's what's wrong with you. You should be kissed and often, and by someone who knows how.
Oh, and I suppose you think you're the proper person.
I might be, if the right moment ever came.
Directors in the 1930s also produced such great films as It Happened One Night, Mutiny on the Bounty, and The Life of Emile Zola.
The success of radio and films, as well as the Depression itself, caused problems for many American newspapers during the 1930s. The trouble was not so much that readers stopped buying newspapers. It was that companies talked about their products through advertisements on radio instead of buying advertising space in newspapers. Nearly half of the nation's independently published newspapers either stopped publishing or joined larger companies during the 1930s. By World War II, only 120 cities had competing newspapers.
Weekly and monthly publications faced the same problem as daily newspapers: increased competition from radio and films. Many magazines failed. The two big successes of the period were Life magazine and the Reader's Digest. Life magazine had stories for everyone about film actors, news events, or just daily life in the home or on the farm. Its photographs were the greatest anywhere. Reader's Digest published shorter forms of stories from other magazines and sources.
Most popular books of the period were like the films coming from Hollywood. Writers cared more about helping people forget their troubles than about facing serious social issues. They made more money that way, too. But a number of writers in the 1930s did produce books that were both profitable and of high quality. One was Sinclair Lewis. His book, It Can't Happen Here, warned of the coming dangers of fascism. John Steinbeck's great book, The Grapes of Wrath, helped millions understand and feel in their hearts the troubles faced by poor farmers. Erskine Caldwell wrote about the cruelty of life among poor people in the southeastern United States, and James T. Farrell about life in Chicago.
The same social concern and desire to present life as it really existed also were clear in the work of many American artists during the 1930s. Thomas Benton painted workers and others with strong, tough bodies. Edward Hopper showed the sad streets of American cities. Reginald Marsh painted picture after picture of poor parts of New York City. The federal government created a program that gave jobs to artists. They painted their pictures on the walls of airports, post offices, and schools. The program brought their ideas and creativity to millions of people. At the same time, photography became more important as cameras improved in quality and became more movable. Some photographers, like Margaret Burke White and Walker Evans, used their cameras to report the hard conditions of the Depression.
All this activity in the arts and popular culture played an important part in the lives of Americans during the 1930s. It not only provided relief from their troubles, but expanded their minds and pushed their imaginations. The tensions and troubles of the Great Depression provided a rich atmosphere for artists and others to produce works that were serious, foolish, or just plain fun. And those works, in turn, helped make life a little better as Americans waited, worked, and hoped for times to improve.
And that is our program for today. Thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Ana Mateo.